Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Progressive News Network Extra with Brooke Hines. It is Thursday, November 7 at noon, and we have Ben America with us. Hello, Ben America.
Hello, Brooke. How are you?
I am well. Thank you for joining us. Do I hear a cat?
Absolutely. No, That is not a cat. Although I can get a little catty, don't let it fool you.
Okay.
So.
I don't know why I was hearing some meowing on the line. There it is again. Do you hear it?
I don't.
Oh,
it's on your end. It must be.
It's on my end. So that's kind of funny because I just tweeted out the promotion for going live. And I put a flying cat in the tweet. So,
well, the cat's part of the discussion, then. I mean,
That's
gonna have
happens.
To cat pundit.
Uh huh. Okay, so we're here. I've set aside 60 minutes to talk about strategy going into 2020. But are you by any chance on a speakerphone?
No.
Wow. Where is that?
No,
sound
I'm on the.
From? Okay. I'm going to let you introduce yourself and give the listeners a sense of who Ben America is, what you're about, and then we'll jump into our content for today.
Who is Ben America? On the banks of the Mississippi River I'm a political strategist. I have been involved in Democratic Party politics since 2004. I'm a progressive, a liberal to the left of the center, and excited about what the 2020 cycle offers in terms of engaging voters and supporting a message that is one that provides solutions. So we've waited a long time to see a lot of the issues that the progressive left has, you know, said are should be priorities policy-wise. And this cycle, they've really been advanced. And there's a clear delineation. There's a clear delineation between people who are, you know, let's get back to what's normal, and the side of the movement that says, we've got an opportunity here. Let's not lose that perspective, and let's take full advantage of that, with Trump being one of the most unpopular presidents in history.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts coming out of the elections last night as to what's going on in 2020?
I mean, you know, the thing that you'll get over and over again about those elections in the reporting is that they nationalized the message. It was a referendum on Trump. And we saw that, you know, prior to the 2018 midterms, we saw these, you know, races that were not on the general election cycle or on the midterm election cycle, with Democrats closing the gap on the performance that had been there in 2016. They were closing the gaps on that. So one of the things that came out of Kentucky was the fact that if you looked at the map, there were these two counties in the top of Kentucky that are actually suburbs of Cincinnati. And those both went for Trump in 2016. In this election, they both went blue, which means that that Panera strategy has some level of validity, I suppose. But I think that's more a reflection on the fact that you had middle-class voters not seeing the benefits of Trump being president, and that he was more a danger than his supposed great economy that he's built.
Well, there was also the race in Seattle where you had the council person, Sawat, and I'm not saying her name right, but she lost in an avalanche of spending by Amazon, by Silicon Valley money.
Well, that's, you know, that's the sort of the issue with Silicon Valley in the first place, right? You know, because there's a lot of Democrats who think, okay, well, we have natural alliances there. These are going to be more progressive people. But what you find is that they're really more libertarian. And so whenever you've got someone who is, you know, wants to use the collective power of government to improve people's lives, they're fine with that if it's, you know, building the backbone for the internet or making sure that our telecommunications network is strong in this country, federal spending on that. But the minute that we step in and localize some of these issues and sort of take them on in terms of the money that they're making off of our data, you know, they push back on that. They don't, they're, that's, you know, that's turf that we're stepping into, you know, their territory there.
Mm-hmm. So if the Panera strategy works in Kentucky, what kind of strategy do you think we might need to think about in terms of places like Seattle? What do you think they did wrong?
You know, I honestly don't know. I mean, if I'd have to, you know, I'd have to spend some more time digging into what that race looked like. You know, what kind of research they put on the ground. That would be what I would look at. So because I can't give you any insight on what actually happened, I'll tell you what I would look at to find out what happened. You want to look at what they did in terms of direct voter contact. Why was the, you know, sponsored message by Silicon Valley to vote against this person? Why was that successful? What made that successful and what conditions were there? You know, I really don't know. Washington's a weird place, man. Washington's an odd place. So it's hard to make sense sometimes of, because we automatically think of it as a liberal state, but there's a lot of Washington that's not very liberal. It's very conservative. And so, you know, how much of that had influence on that race?
All right. So enough of the small talk. We wanted to sit down and have a discussion about caucuses and Iowa and the 2020 strategy kind of writ large. And you had some ideas, you had some thoughts about how important Iowa is and why Iowa is important. So let's start there. What are your thoughts about what's going on in Iowa and what does that mean to this race for the candidates and for the supporters of the different candidates?
My first thought is whenever we go into this segment, we should start it off with that that music that starts right before a football game. You know, this is like, are you ready for some football or something? Like, this is – the Iowa caucuses are full contact, grassroots. It is the backbone of American politics. There's a lot of people who don't like the fact that Iowa is the first state. But here's the thing. Iowa is this really interesting place in terms of Midwest politics. And beyond that, they recognize their responsibility in terms of having a first vote. This isn't like a primary where everybody goes, gets in line, and then they cast the vote. This is people going into a room, and at a specified time, they break out into who they're supporting. And so there is still some campaigning to do when you walk in that room at the Iowa caucus. And so what we're looking at is as it stands, there's not a lot of activity in terms of the Biden campaign, for instance, on the ground. There's Kamala has some people there, Kamala Harris, Senator Harris, Warren and Buttigieg have actually, they've opened more field offices than Bernie has. But the highlight of that is the fact that for Bernie Sanders fans, he's got a network that allows people to connect where they don't need a field office. And so that has been very powerful. And when you look at what that means in terms of going into the caucuses, that means that they've got a broad decentralized network that's going to allow them to communicate that whole time. And so they're going to know what they're getting on the ground and where they're getting it. And that's really the technology in that is really exciting.
So we know what it means to walk into a caucus in Iowa, and that I think a lot of people are, at least Iowans, are familiar with the participatory nature of what goes on and how caucuses work. Do you have any sense of how that plays out with maybe first-time voters or people who aren't familiar with it? Do you think that that's something that catches them by surprise? Do you think that this is something that the campaigns put some amount of effort into educating the voters about?
Well, I mean, think about it. You know, you're putting Dancing with the Stars on DVR. You're not going and sitting on your couch that night and watching TV. You're leaving your house, maybe coming from work, you know, to go to this caucus location, which is probably like a high school gymnasium. And there's all of these people that you don't know there. And now you've got a group of people that you're going to be with that are supporting the candidate that you're supporting. And you got to kind of find who that is. So, you know, logistically on the ground, if you're a campaign, you've got some representatives there to kind of guide people into that space to prepare them. And we're talking about literally like hundreds of precincts where this is happening, right? So so you've got these people there, you know, they're talking to each other, they're discussing things. And at the same time, you've got some people who show up to the caucuses regularly. They understand this process. They're tuned into the campaign strategy. They're overworking other candidates, supporters prior to the caucus vote. And, you know, they're making their argument. And for the heart of the Democratic Party in that room on caucus night, we're going to see the case made for or not made for why the policies of the progressive left are the platform that we need to run with, and we need someone authentic to represent that.
Mm-hmm. So walk us through your thoughts on the strategic importance of Iowa.
Well, Iowa, you know, first of all, the numbers that come out of Iowa are going to be, that's the first thing anybody's going to look at, right? So, for instance, in 2008 in Iowa, for the first time since they've been tracking numbers, the 18 to 29 demographic was five times higher than the 65 and over. And that portended for the general election – a higher turnout among young voters. And that's so important, because now you're able to say, okay, well, if we can look at what's happening in terms of voter turnout in Iowa, that's going to teach us something about the general election. Furthermore, whatever happens in Iowa reverberates across America, except for New Hampshire, because New Hampshire voters are assholes. Yeah, I said it. I said New Hampshire voters are assholes. Well, not to get too far away from Iowa, but New Hampshire voters are the type of voters that the pundits are saying, oh, well, they're trending towards candidate A. And New Hampshire voters will see that and go, screw you, I'm voting for candidate B. So, because, you know, live free or die. But back to Iowa, what that means is that, you know, look, while a lot of these other campaigns are competing for voters in that likely voter space, what the Sanders campaign has said that they are doing different is they are going out and they are looking at people who do not fit into the description of likely voter. And the reason that they're doing that is twofold. One, because there's a limited number of people within the universe of likely voters that they're going to get. That's just how it is. So if you want to win, you got to go outside of that number. So that's number one. The second thing is because the reason Bernie Sanders gives, his argument for why he is a better choice for president, to be the nominee, is because he brings in people that the Democratic Party can't get. And he brings in money that the Democratic Party can't get. And their argument is look, if we're bringing in voters that you can't get, and we know we're going to get your voters, we know we're going to get the Democratic Party voters, because, you know, they've all been running around saying vote blue no matter who, right? So we know we're going to get, so obviously they're going to vote for Bernie. We know we're going to get those voters. But what we're bringing to the table is a group of voters that makes up any other, you know, the gap on any other swollen turnout by Republicans. So we're in this very unique situation with Bernie, in that Bernie could bring to the table a set of voters that normally don't vote, number one. Bernie can coalesce the Democratic Party vote overall. And number three is you've got these people that live in the suburbs of Cincinnati that are so sick of Trump that they will vote against him. Now, does that fall off depending upon more liberal, how liberal you are or how progressive you are? Is there fall off there? That's Elizabeth Warren's argument. Elizabeth Warren is like, I can go get those votes. Bernie can't get those votes. So if Bernie doesn't increase the size of the voter universe in Iowa, then Elizabeth Warren has a stronger argument for being the nominee.
Okay, say that again. The size of the voter universe in Iowa.
So, you know, your voter universe is anyone who's registered to vote. That's your whole universe, mm-hmm. right? Well, within mm-hmm. that universe, you have some subsets. You've got likely voters and unlikely voters. So what most campaigns do is focus on the likely voters because they're likely to vote. What the Sanders campaign is doing is they're focusing on unlikely voters because they're trying to expand the pool of voters within the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Not every one of those people that's registered to vote is going to show up to the caucuses. In fact, mm-hmm. it's arguable that most of them won't. But the ones that do – those likely voters, those people who are generally there, there's a – like you've already got carved out within that most of what you're going to get, right? So Bernie's plan is let's go outside of that group of voters, that pool of voters, the likely voters in within the voter universe, and expand that pool to include people who normally don't vote. And again, if Bernie brings those people to the table at the caucuses – He is making the case for why he should be the choice for nominee. Mm-hmm. If he doesn't bring those people to the caucuses, it strengthens Elizabeth Warren's position.
So what is the, how do we determine if he brings those people to the table? Is it just whether or not he wins?
Well, I mean, that's going to be part of it, but more importantly, we'll be able to see in the exit polling that there was a large number of people who this was their first caucus. They'll ask that question, exit polling. I mean, you could do it with a voter file too. You know, if you had the Iowa voter file, you know, and you can see who showed up to the caucuses, you can tell that information yourself. And of course, that information is all public. So.
Okay, so I want to make sure that I'm getting this right. So you're saying that Elizabeth Warren is not making the same argument, that Elizabeth Warren is not trying to bring unlikely voters to caucus in Iowa. So Elizabeth Warren doesn't bring the same competitive advantage that Bernie Sanders brings to Iowa or to the race in general,
Elizabeth Warren may very well bring, you know, people who have never participated in a caucus to the caucuses before. I just don't think that that is the base of the pool of support they're going after now. I'm sure that they're looking to expand that, their targets. So we'll kind of have to, we kind of have to see, you know, that'll be what you're looking for. That'll be what you're looking for at the caucuses. You're going to be looking for who brought in the people who normally don't vote. Now, again, the reason we're talking about this is because the Bernie campaign argument, the argument from the far left of the Democratic Party is that Bernie speaks to a set of voters that the Democratic Party and their candidates can't speak to. And he turns that group of voters out. He does. So that's the argument he's trying to make. And so they're really banking on that. Whereas the Warren campaign is expanding their reach within the pool of likely voters at the moment. You know, at the same time, there's the Sanders campaign is you know, looking to spend more than $30 million on TV advertising in the first four states in California. So, I mean, you know, they've already spent $1.3 million. And they bought a million of time in New Hampshire. So that, you know, they're not just depending upon that unlikely voter, but the argument that they really would like to be in the position of making is that Bernie brings in a voter that you can't get to.
So in 2016, the exit polling in Iowa for the primary was when asked the question, have you ever voted in a caucus before, 59% of Hillary Clinton voters had voted in a caucus prior to that year. And the exact same number of Bernie Sanders supporters had not participated in a caucus prior to that year.
So 60-40. You know, 60-40 for Hillary, that 60% of them had voted in a caucus before, but for Bernie, only 40% had voted in a caucus before.
Approximately.
So, yeah.
And
I mean, that's the argument, right? That's him making that argument. And you know, how did Iowa turn out? You know, I think, wasn't there a coin flip at one of the caucuses?
There were three coin flips. All the coin mm-hmm. flips went to Hillary. And then there was, in the end, I believe it was two-tenths or two-hundredths of a percent. I mean, it was for all intents and purposes a tie with Iowa last time around.
And how many, and I think if you look at that, you'll find there were 89, I want to say it was 89 precincts that had no votes cast in them. So, you know, look, when you look at that stuff and you're a decentralized field operation, you know you can go get some easy wins by picking up these precincts where nobody showed up before. Now, the question is, do they have the people power to support a campaign that's not only managing these caucuses on the ground, but turning out people in these precincts where no one's ever showed up before to caucus? You know, nobody's showing up to caucus. They're just zero precincts.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's really, you know, if you start seeing a whole bunch of precincts with, like, you know, one Bernie caucus goer at it, you're going to know, that's going to tell you what you know, you need to know about their operation. If they're hitting on all four cylinders in that operation, you know, bringing in unlikely voters and then at the caucus making the argument, look, this is a set of voters we can get to, come support Bernie, come be on the team of Bernie, and let's win this thing with a group of voters that doesn't normally vote. That's the second thing. They've got to do that at the caucuses. Third, they've got to make sure that they fill the empty caucuses. And, you know, most importantly, they've got to get out the vote. I mean, that's just, you know, they've got to turn their people out. So if they do, they make a very strong case for why Bernie should be the nominee. I mean, I think it's pretty clear in this election cycle that Elizabeth Warren is sort of the compromise candidate across the board. You know, there's a lot of people who like Biden. They like Pete, you know, and maybe one or two of them are Amy Klobuchar fans. Sorry, Greg Goddard. But yeah, you know, they will consider a Elizabeth Warren. They will not be as excited about a Bernie Sanders. And there are people who like Bernie that, and I think you can see that in the polling. If you look at, you know, who did you vote for in the last primary or the last caucus, you see a large portion of Elizabeth Warren's support come from 2016 Bernie voters. So, you know, do you go back in that evening, you know, what does that conversation look like? The Elizabeth Warren people, you know, if they are competing with a group of Bernie people, they're like, look, we can get those people over there that, you know, are talking amongst the three of themselves. We can get them to support, you know, those Joe Biden people to support Elizabeth Warren, but we can't get them to support Bernie. You know, do the Bernie people start peeling off? Oh, yeah, you know, it's probably the better way to go. That's the space she's carved out for herself. And then, of course, Pete has carved out a space between her and Biden. I'm just not so sure I'm not so sure anybody's shopping in that section of the store.
So almost 30% of Biden supporters pick Sanders as second choice.
Well, those are Hillary votes.
So in polling where they're asking first choice, like rank choice, there's let me see what the data on this is. As of, so this is from The Hill. Okay, so as of May, there was 30% of Biden supporters picked Sanders as second choice. As of, and I'm sure there's been some movement in that. Looking at who's second choice, I think is a really good way of determining what kind of vote that is. So a lot of people who are supporting Biden, you could say, and this is not me making this up, this is, you know, pretty much been a theme in coverage, has been that Biden is seen as the electable candidate and seen as potentially a strong candidate against Donald Trump. And so when people look at, when people are asked what their second choice is, they're looking for a second choice that is, has that kind of competitiveness. In other words, it doesn't seem to me like this first choice, second choice thing, especially with Biden, is about ideology. It's more about who they think can win.
Mm-hmm. That's, but that's been the horse race the entire time, right? That's like electability, 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 you know. And look, if you look at the swing states, if you go and you look at where the polling in the swing states, the reason that they are motivated to vote in Michigan, Minnesota, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin is to defeat Trump. When you ask them, Cook did the opinion polling there in those swing states, Michigan, Minnesota, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, and they asked, to defeat Trump, is that why you're voting? It's my civic duty. Healthcare, to reelect Donald Trump because I don't want a Democrat, or the economy. So across the board, 21% said to defeat Trump, 9% said it's my civic duty, 8% said it was healthcare, 8% said I don't want a Democrat, and 4% said the economy. 21% said to defeat Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, people aren't going to vote for healthcare. And that's a problem for left, you know, for Elizabeth Warren and for Bernie Sanders. They're not going to vote for healthcare. They're voting to beat Donald Trump. And so the argument is going to be tough.
Can you share what that is again that you're reading?
It's on opiniontoday.com. I'll send you the I'll send you the tweet.
Is that a USA Today thing?
It's pulling from Cook, from a Cook poll. It's the pollingreport.com. I don't know if you are familiar with pollingreport.com. If you're not, you should be. It's a great website, super nerdy. And also, you can purchase state polls, which is really cool. The most recent poll they have up is the Monmouth poll, and that one has Biden at 23, Warren at 23, and Bernie at 20. So that's the thing, right? So just like pause for a second and just think about this. Anyone who gets if you get 14.9% of the caucus goers in Iowa, you don't get any delegates. You don't get any delegates.
Say that again.
To get delegates, if you get 14.9% of the caucus goers in Iowa, 14.9%, you don't get any delegates. No allocated delegates. You've got to get 15% or better to get allocated delegates. Now, let's say this Monmouth poll carries, and this is how it turns out: 23% for Joe Biden, 23% for Elizabeth Warren, and 20% for Bernie Sanders. That's what walks in the door. What happens when the 2% that are Amy Klobuchar people, the 3% that are Andrew Yang people, the 3% that are Cory Booker people, you know, they realize they're not going to get any delegate votes by staying in that corner. It doesn't help. He's not going to win that precinct. So they should go with somebody, their second choice. They should move over to their second choice. This is where Elizabeth Warren is dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
That's where Elizabeth, to the Bernie people, that's where Elizabeth Warren is dangerous, because she is she has a higher second choice ranking than does Bernie Sanders.
So let me just get this out of the way. You don't currently work for any of the campaigns, right?
Uh-oh. Not a one.
And you're not, are you seeking to work for any of the campaigns? You have not declared.
I've applied to the Sanders campaign and I've applied to the Warren campaign, just kind of because, I'm looking at something else right now, but I like both of those campaigns. Here's a really interesting insight into the Warren campaign. The Warren campaign really understands the need for precinct building. There's a really bright spot in her campaign. When you talk to the people inside
her
campaign,
how does she show that? How is that communicated?
Because in their organizing models, they're looking to get these people that are showing up as super volunteers plugged in as precinct people in their county parties. That's what they're looking to do.
So they've got supporters that they know are supporting their campaign, and let's say these supporters aren't already involved in any kind of Democratic politics, and they're saying, go down to your county Democratic Executive Committee, your DEC, and sign up to be a precinct captain?
Yeah, they're that's exactly what they're doing. And that's really promising. I think, again, I kind of go back to the fact that, Bernie is where I want to be philosophically. Warren gives us enough of that to be authentic and speak to a set of voters that we may not normally speak to, but she also understands the importance of party building.
So where can listeners get information on this precinct program that Warren's doing?
I don't know. I don't know that they're actively talking about it. I just know, outside of the campaign, other than, directly to the people that they're working with.
You got from talking to somebody within the Warren campaign, and they're like, oh, well, here's something we're doing. We're encouraging people to go become precinct captains. Is that where that came from?
Elizabeth Warren has herself made that a priority.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so here's a differentiation again between Bernie and Warren. When Bernie lost, he built Our Revolution. Our Revolution was organized in clusters largely around regions or communities across the country. But there was no directive to then go and engage the county party. That has largely been avoided by the Bernie organization. Although you talk to people on the inside of Our Revolution and it drives them crazy because they think that's exactly what they should be doing.
Keep talking like this and you're going to get yourself a job on the Warren campaign.
I'm not necessarily promoting Elizabeth Warren by saying this. I'm just saying
that.
Yeah,
but you are because it's anecdotal. So someone told you that there's a program and a platform to do all this stuff with the precincts. And based on a assessment of what Our Revolution is about, comparing Our Revolution to this anecdotal information about Warren, you're saying that look at how much better Elizabeth Warren is for county party stuff. I mean, you kind of see how those two things they're not equal. You can't really do that, right?
Well, what I'm saying is that you look at a campaign and you look at its priorities. And that tells you something about who's in charge. If I talk to the Elizabeth Warren people and they say that within their strategy is a strategy to beef up the county parties as part of what they're doing. In other words, there's a legacy idea behind this, that this isn't just a one and done kind of thing. Yeah, that's important. That's, because that's what if you're going to build a political revolution and you're going to leave party politics out of it, you're doing it wrong. The party is still relevant. And there are a lot of people that will tell you that the party's not relevant, and that's from very establishment candidates establishment consultants will tell you the party is dead, and the people on very liberal organizers and activists and operatives will tell you that the party is dead. And yet you ask a Bernie person about what happened in 2016 and they'll blame the party. So it's like you can have it one way or the other. Like if you don't want the party interfering in the election like that, then that means that you have to change the culture of the party. And so if the Sanders campaign never drew that line in their organizing. And that is significant. That is significant. Especially when one of the
I wonder where you're getting your information, because so there was a ton of press in 2017 about how Bernie Sanders loyalists were taking over the Democratic Party one county at a time and one precinct at a time.
That wasn't done through our revolution. That was done because those people took it upon themselves to do it. I mean, I knew a lot of those people.
Well, you can't do it through our revolution because our revolution is a C4 organization. So they can't exactly – a C4 can't go and, directly –
PDA does it all the time. PDA says they have an inside-outside strategy, right? Their argument is that we work within the party to move the party to the left. So they have – I mean, it's the same strategy with PDA. So our revolution, they were building these clusters of organizers in communities, but they weren't connecting the dots to go and engage the party. Now, I'm not – again, this isn't – there's plenty about what the Sanders campaign has done that you can critique, and that's fair. You should. Nobody runs a perfect campaign. Nobody runs a perfect political operation. Elizabeth Warren certainly isn't running a perfect political operation.
So let's go ahead and make a couple columns then. What do you think that the Bernie Sanders campaign is doing right? And we'll start there.
Reaching out to voters who are not part of the likely voter universe. They're raising money from people in a small to mid-level donor network that is really the future of political fundraising. They are continuing to organize decentralized field models, which is beyond brilliant. That is legitimately the only way we do it. You empower the community organizer and you put that person to work and you tie them into a network that gives them the information that they need, but you let them make those decisions on the ground. And I think that's the power of the Bernie Sanders model. It's the question is that going to translate on caucus day to a pool of voters that normally don't show up to election day or to caucus showing up and them winning caucus after caucus after caucus because of this groundswell of voters. So the Sanders campaign is doing a lot right. It's hard. Some of it – now, what I will also say is, that there has to be – there has to be some message discipline in terms of being able to keep some of their surrogates from being attack dogs. That has become a problem.
Can you give an example?
You got the whole John King thing. You got the stuff with yesterday. You've got Sean King that's out there that Sean King constantly, I mean, that guy's an attack dog. I mean, it's just what he is. And that's who he is by nature. But then you've got the endorsement yesterday and look, you're always going to have the crazy people on campaigns. You're always going to have the people whose car is held together by bumper stickers, have those people show up. Right. But what we've got to do is we've got to make that pragmatic argument, because we have to remember who we're arguing to. We're arguing to the people who consider themselves pragmatic progressives. Okay, you're pragmatic. Let me make the pragmatic argument to you. We get money that you can't get. We get voters that you can't get. If Bernie's the nominee, we expand the people who are going to vote for the Democratic nominee, which wins us across the board, and we bring in money that that helps us get there, but doesn't take anything away from what the DNC is doing. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot they're doing well, but it's a campaign, right? It's a campaign, and so there's going to be you know, you've got to deliver on that when it comes down to caucus day.
Yeah, well, you know, I was so you actually applied to the Bernie Sanders campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And in Florida.
I applied for a Florida position, and then I applied for a national position. So, mm-hmm. You know, just like wherever you need me, kind of thing. And so. But
and you applied for a position with Warren's campaign, right?
Yeah, I applied for training director on their campaign and for a state director.
Because I wasn't, I wasn't aware that you had actually been pursuing a job with Bernie Sanders. I was aware that you were pursuing something with Warren, but you know, I mean, whoever gets to Ben first, they win. He's an excellent.
I just want to say, honestly, I didn't really chase down, you know, when you apply for a political campaign, there's a lot of politics that goes along with it. Shocked to discover politics. And I didn't really do that. I didn't, you know, make the calls. I didn't, you know, position myself for that. I really want to work for the party itself, because I think that people that have a liberal policy, like we're ideologically liberal, bring something to the party that a lot of times gets washed out in just simply where you get your people from. You know, you and I have talked about this a lot, the club that is in politics of people who are the consultants, who are the, you know, who get hired and how you get hired and how you get on. And, you know, the Sanders campaign is not immune to that. I feel like I would be serving best is in a space where I'm helping to develop the talent of the next generation, that next cycle talent, those next field directors, those next communication directors, campaign managers, developing the candidates on the ground and working in that space. And so that's where I want to be, because I think that that's the best use of my resources. But you can't pass up an opportunity to at least interview for a position on a presidential campaign. I mean, you know,
for sure.
Of course you'd love to be the person that just gets a phone call, you know, hey, we need you, you know, you'd love to be that person, but I'm not there yet. So
are you up on any of the organizing that is happening with regard to the professional side of campaigns in Florida? Like, you mentioned Warren, are they getting ready to launch their, you know, field here? Like who's going, in other words, who's going to be paying attention to Florida?
So right now, I am not aware, but I'm not sure that I would know if the Bernie team has a state director yet. I know the Warren campaign has a state director. I think the Biden campaign has a political director, if not a state director already. Beyond that, I'm not sure. I know Buttigieg has some, Pete's got some, a lot of relationships down here in Florida with network that they've already established. So,
hey,
you know, Florida's an odd.
Yeah, Florida is odd, you know, because we're like one of the largest states, and we also are, you know, we're kind of locked down when it comes to the party. The party holds a lot of control, and you know, there's that. But you mentioned Mayor Pete Buttigieg. And, you know, there's some indication, even though he's running at a fourth, it's a strong fourth, that he could come out of some of these early primaries with a chance. Do you think Pete Buttigieg has a race problem?
In his polling, yes. Personally, man, you know, that's a hard question to answer. I think what his record as a public servant has demonstrated is that he has had a he's got some problems around him. You know, there was the chief of police, and then there was the shooting. And in both of those circumstances, he just seemed sort of aloof to it. I think on the shooting, the police related shooting, I think he was caught flat footed on that one. I don't think he was paying a lot of attention to what was going on in his backyard. I think he was really focused on his presidential campaign. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that'll do it to you. And you hate to see that for somebody, because I like, you know, look, I love listening to Pete speak. I think he's a fantastic speaker. I read something the other day that he's kind of a throwback candidate. You know, he talks like the politicians of a boomer era. He is young and is going to be around for a long time. So he's got a lot of development to do. I don't think this is his race. I don't think he.
Did you just say that, that Buttigieg is a throwback to the boomer era? Is that what that was?
Yeah. The way that he speaks, the way that he articulates, he sounds like one of those politicians from, you know, the JFK model. You know, they're like, you know, if you took a basketball player and you put him in front of Michael Jordan film and had him watch a bunch of Michael Jordan film, then they're going to go try to be like Michael Jordan. Like they stuck a bunch of JFK film in front of Pete Buttigieg. And that's, you know, he's trying to channel that. And he doesn't do a bad job. The problem is that in his articulation, he's also very evasive. And, you know, there was a time when that was a talent for a politician. Now that's not really a talent anymore. And so you see his support coming from people who like those politicians with a shine on them, you know? And so, you know, I think, again, Pete's going to be around for a long time. And, you know, maybe that means that he'll migrate back to Medicare for All. So, you know, the unfortunate part about his campaign is I think he has been a crafted candidate. I think that's, to me, that's more of the conversation than his issues on race. I think if you look at how he changed from an M4A guy to a Medicare for anyone who wants it, you know, I think if you look at just that, some of his language, some of the way he's postured and positioned himself, I think it's obvious to see the fingerprints of the consultants that he's working with.
Well, you know, I find it interesting that Buttigieg doesn't necessarily have a race problem, you know, given what was going on in South Bend with his police force. And that in 2016, Bernie Sanders had a huge race problem. Like he was like, you know, like some, you know, like terrible person or whatever, regardless of the fact that he was, you know, very early to the table to work for to work on civil rights issues, you know, had an arrest record with regard to working with the civil rights issues and stuff. And so you heard over and over again that Bernie Sanders has a race problem. That means he's unelectable. End of story. Race problem, unelectable. So why isn't Pete Buttigieg unelectable with his race problem?
Well, let's go back to first of all, Pete Buttigieg is unelectable for a number of reasons, but let's go back to the point about 2016. So what you had was you had a number of different you had a narrative about Bernie that came out that Bernie has a race problem based on two things. The first thing was his inability to make a huge dent in time, to make enough of a dent in time with African-American voters to have a plurality in that space to beat Hillary Clinton. And part of that is because for many of those people, they didn't know who Bernie Sanders was. It's the same thing that's happening with Joe Biden. Why is Joe Biden get the African-American support that he had? Was it because of Barack Obama? Well, it's that that's who they know. And so, you know, for us that were Bernie people in 2016 and that were talking about the work that he had done, you know, in over the years and on issues around race and how he had been a leader in his time. He was ahead of his time in terms of how he engaged that space. That was all being passed around between us, and it wasn't getting outside of our little bubble, and it wasn't getting to those voters. And because that wasn't getting communicated to those voters weren't seeing this long history. Now, you know, but they had 30 years of Clinton. They had 30 years. And, you know, remember, you remember back before Obama was elected and people used to say, well, you know, Bill Clinton was the first black president, you know, because black people liked him so much. That was a thing. That they have a long relationship in areas like South Carolina. Those are the places that, you know, Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton would go to stump for some, you know, backwoods state legislature candidate. They would be there. And that's why they had that support there going back. And you had those state legislators, you know, those state legislators that got elected because Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton came down and stumped for them. You had them telling the people in their districts, hey, look, the Clintons are where it's at. Those are those. That's who I'm supporting. So like that's a process. That's just politics. Right. That's what we've had since then. We've had more of a conversation about this. We've talked more about what Bernie's past is. Bernie has name ID in that space. So I'm, you know, I don't think the whole electable conversation. Look, you know who's electable? The people, the candidates people elect. Like until you're, you know, you can't look at electability ahead of the voter. The voter decides whether or not that's somebody that they want to vote for. And again, it comes down to your argument for why you're the best choice, right? And each of them is trying to posture for why they're the best choice. You know, Pete's argument for why he's the best choice is he's in between Biden and Warren. You know?
So let's imagine, let's do a thought experiment. It's November a year from now, and no, let's say it's like June a year from now, and we've already done the primary. We know who's getting ready to run up against Trump. Imagine for a second that it's Elizabeth Warren debating Donald Trump. How's that going to go?
I think Elizabeth Warren has the skin to deal with Donald Trump. And I think what you're going to see there is her be condescending to him in a way that frustrates him. It was something
and,
Hillary just couldn't pull off.
And in the last
it was something Hillary.
Minute, that to Bernie.
Bernie's the heavyweight. I mean, you know, that's like, you know, Tyson and the guy he bit the guy's ear off, you know, Holyfield. Like, you know, Bernie's going to go in there to be dismissive. He's going to hit with the, you know, on the key points about how, you know, Donald Trump is a representation of the 1% and how they're destroying America. You know, he's just going to go at it.
Got it. So I got right up against the hour, and we're going to get – we have a hard break, and we're going to get cut off. So I wanted to make sure that we got those two in before the end. And I feel like this conversation started out at Iowa, and we wound up kind of in Florida. But Ben, thank you so much. I want you to come back and we're going to finish this discussion and talk real soon.
Thanks for having me.
All right. All right, guys. Thanks for tuning in. This was Progressive News Network Extra. Catch it on the pod. See you later. Don't buy everything that's true.